This is Ashoka Changemakers,
brought to you by the Innovate Podcast in collaboration with Ashoka and Arch Street Press. Here's your host, David M. Castro.
Today, our guest is Megan Marcus, founder and CEO of FuelEd, an organization that improves student and school outcomes by equipping educators with the social and emotional skills that are essential for building secure relationships that enhance learning. Megan has earned a BA in psychology from the University of California at Berkeley and a master's degree in psychology from Pepperdine University. While she was at Pepperdine, Megan studied under Dr. Louis Cozzolino and served as the lead researcher for his book, The Social Neuroscience of Education. Megan then completed a master's degree in education policy and management at Harvard University, where she explored how to translate the elements of a therapist's professional training to an educational setting. Her research with Dr. Cozzolino and studies at Harvard combined to form the core beliefs that became the bedrock of FuelEd. Since 2012, Megan has passionately served the educational community as FuelEd's CEO. Among her many accolades, Megan is an Ashoka Fellow, and that's an experience we share. Megan, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your life and work today.
Thank you for having me here, David. I'm very excited.
Awesome. Today, we want to explore not only FuelEd, but your emergence as a leader and an innovator within the changemaker education movement. And I'd love it if you could tell me a little bit about your early life, where you first became intrigued with psychology and education.
Yeah, I was always interested in people and people development. I had a kind of natural inclination towards relationships and connecting with folks and understanding their inner world, my own inner world. My mom is a clinical psychologist. And so I grew up this strange kid who was weirdly very interested in what she did for a living. Early on, I remember asking her, what are you doing there with your patients? What are you doing there talking to them? What are they talking about? What are they getting out of this experience? And would always just love learning more about it. As I grew up, I continued to be interested in psychology, and so studied psychology as an undergrad at UC Berkeley, and had an incredible opportunity after that to work as a researcher at Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles. At that point, I had a chance to go to a conference called Learning in the Brain, where educators gather to learn about the latest research from neuroscience, psychology, child development. And I was going simply as a research assistant to present a poster presentation on the center I was working at Cal State Northridge called the Teaching, Learning, Counseling Consortium. And I was pretty floored at that conference. It was a catalytic moment for me when I looked out across the sea of educators. A lot of them were veteran, and they were just hungry for this information about psychology and neuroscience and child development, this learning that I had done as this little, 21-year-old through my college experience. And yet here were these people who were working day in and day out with children, spending more time with kiddos than even the best parents can. And they were having to come to this one-off conference to learn about these basics about human development. I was very confused. It was kind of the first moment for me where I said, hold the phone. Isn't this what teachers learn in their teacher preparation program? Something is seriously wrong here if educators are having to come across the country to this conference to learn some of these things that I consider foundational. So that was my first kind of insight into teacher preparation and what could be somewhat awry. I was also exposed to Dr. Lou Cozzolino, where I learned more about this field of social neuroscience, which is a field that as a discipline looks at the brain as a social organ and humans as social creatures, and that we're really wired to connect. Throughout human history, we've learned and survived by being in relationships, and I just thought this was the coolest thing ever. It's what I believed in my whole life at my core. And then suddenly I was learning, wow, there's a whole field of research backing this up. This is science. So I was just on fire from that experience. I followed Dr. Cozzolino about a year later, kind of looked him up, found him again, and told him about my burgeoning interest in psychology, neuroscience, and education. And he said, well, I'm about to start writing a book called The Social Neuroscience of Education. Why don't you join me? And in the meantime, you can get your master's in psychology. And so 2 weeks later, there I was, a master's student in psychology, studying with Dr. Cozzolino and working on this book, which served as the foundation for the insights that led me to begin my journey with FuelEd.
Wow, what a great story. I really want to do a dive into your work with Dr. Cozzolino, but before I do that, I wanted to ask you take a slightly different tack, which is your work as a social entrepreneur. And I wonder a little bit about the roots of that. So we have already some really great insight that your mom was a clinical psychologist, so you grow up with psychology in the family and some knowledge and interest with psychology. But what about this social entrepreneur role where you decide, you know, hey, I'm not only intrigued with this, but I want to take the lead, I want to develop an organization, I want to change the world. Where do you see the roots of that in your early life?
That's a great question, David. I've thought a lot about it, especially in my conversations with Ashoka, as they're, you know, kind of helping us formulate and articulate where those foundations really came from. And, you know, looking back, I see that my mom was a clinical psychologist, so that certainly had kind of the content passion there. But as a clinical psychologist, she started her own practice, so a businesswoman as well. And my dad himself was also an entrepreneur. Not a social entrepreneur per se, but, you know, delved into the field of engineering and worked as the president of his own company, built that up. And both my parents, as immigrants to this country, did a lot of kind of pushing to kind of make a new life for themselves. In addition to them kind of hustling on the business side, they were always connected to the community and how they could be of service. So I think that mentality was very much ingrained in me from an early age. But personally, I had no interest or desire to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to be a teacher at a young age, and I wanted to be a therapist in my later years. And it's ironic and coincidental that I've really come together around blending and melding these two fields, serving as a bridge between them. And I simply was driven to do it by the juxtaposition of the huge need that I saw out there in our education system, the huge need I saw for students to have developmental experiences where they feel cared for and nurtured, and coupled with the transformative impact that an educator's ability to build secure relationships could have. So it seemed obvious, it seemed natural, it seemed like I had a tremendous responsibility to do something about it, because I had this vision and insight into how it could really take our society huge leaps ahead if only we could use our education system as this distribution channel, essentially, for healthy, secure relationships that drive learning and development for kiddos.
That's also really interesting. I think that a lot of social entrepreneurs share that part of the story, where there are some examples and there are some role models, but what really lights the fire is just the insight that if I'm going to make the kind of impact that I want to make, I have to be able to create an organization to do it, because alone, I can't do it alone, you know. And so that part of the story really rings true to me. And obviously, Fuel Ed is engaged in having a major impact, and I'd like to begin to talk about that. And I know a lot of it, Fuel Ed's work starts with your experience and the research that you did with Dr. Cozzolino. And I'd love if you could help our audience really understand the nature of this research and what are the key insights that it gives that really form the foundation then for everything that you're doing with Fuel Ed.
Absolutely. That's a great question, David. So my work with Dr. Cozzolino really began with this question or hypothesis. It stated that, you know, we know that humans are social creatures, that we learn through relationships. So given that that research is well-founded, what are the implications for schools, for classrooms, for teachers, for school leaders? If we know that learning and development happens through relationships, how does that change the way we do the institution of school, the places where learning and development should be happening? And so we looked at the ways in which that school systems are very much, unfortunately, set up to flop and fail students and teachers alike, because they're not founded on, they're not built systemically in a way that allows secure relationships to thrive. We also looked at the amazing stories of teachers who were able to place secure relationships at the center of their classroom environment, at the center of the school environment, and the transformative impact that it had on students, of particular importance to students who perhaps have never experienced a secure environment or secure relationship before, students who have come from backgrounds of poverty, trauma, experiencing community violence, These experiences we know impact and impede brain development negatively. And yet, here were these teachers who formed one secure, nurturing relationship with that student and transformed life outcomes forever. That's what the latest research tells us, that it just takes one adult caring about us, one person investing in us, one person providing us that nurturance, helping us feel seen and safe, soothed and secure, that literally changes the brain behavior and can transform life outcomes for kiddos. And so this is what got me most jazzed up. I thought, whoa, every teacher should and can do that. That's how we're training them, right? That's what we're doing. And once again, was shocked to find that no, despite the importance of relationships to an educator's day-to-day job, despite the importance of relationships to an educator's success, to student success, unfortunately, we're training educators as technical instructors, content knowledge, pedagogy, both important for learning. But in reality, educators are counselor figures, parent figures, mentor figures. All of these roles and relationships, they have to connect with parents, with students, with their colleagues. That's the air they breathe. And so I thought this was a huge missed opportunity. And when I took a look at the same time, because I was training to be a counselor, I not only saw this gap in educator preparation, but I saw the parallels between a therapeutic environment and a teaching environment. Both are really interpersonal learning settings where all learning and developmental outcomes really hinge on and happen on the stage of that relationship. So why can't we just adapt or translate some of the best practices in professional development from the similarly interpersonal field, that of the counselor or the therapist, for the teacher to use? And that was sort of the hypothesis of Fuel Ed. When we think about and when we have done the work of adapting that, it includes a few different bright spots. One is the knowledge. Therapists are trained and learn much about human development and psychology, understanding about how those early developmental experiences impact the brain and behavior. And educators are robbed of that opportunity so that when they look at their students, unfortunately, they don't always come with that full insight and understanding of the baggage and the history that the student brings to them and how that's impacting their ability to learn. And that's a disservice to educators to not have that lens. So one thing we do is we expose educators to more of the science of relationships, more knowledge about the research that's out there that we already know about child development that can help them in their classrooms. The second translation that we do is we help educators learn some of the skills to build relationships. Again, not only therapists, but other professions in this country, such as salespeople, customer service representatives, and fundraisers are afforded the opportunity to learn basic interpersonal skills, such as active listening. It's not something that's taught to teachers. The ability for an educator to take in a student's experience, their anxiety, their frustration, their anger, and be able to hold a space for it, to mirror it and say, gosh, I can tell you're really angry. As opposed to jumping to solutions, reassurance, these things that are really natural human instincts in the way we respond, but actually are quite invalidating and can harm not only the relationship, but student development. So equipping educators with some basic interpersonal skills is a really important insight that we are working to bring to the field. Last but not least, the innovation that we're translating from therapist education to teacher education is self-awareness. Research shows that the number one determinant of whether or not we as adults are going to build secure relationships that allow learning and development and healing to thrive, or insecure relationships that actually shut down learning, shut down development, can reinforce trauma. The number one determinant of whether we build secure or insecure relationships is actually our own relationship history. Were we raised and nurtured in an environment by parents or caregivers that built secure or insecure relationships with us? Fortunately for most of us out there, there's a really awesome exception to this rule, which is that when we, at any stage in our lives, develop self-awareness about our early experiences, and usually that happens in the context of a subsequent secure relationship, a mentor, a spouse, a therapist that's supporting you, listening to you, hearing you come to some coherence of your own story, then actually we can change our own attachment style. We can move towards being more secure ourselves, and in doing so, be better able to build secure relationships with others. And so that's why much of Fuel Ed's training not only involves self-awareness, self-insight, becoming aware of what are your triggers in the classroom, what's your natural relationship style, but we also provide the educators we work with and believe that all educators deserve the opportunity to receive counseling services themselves. just like therapists are required to undergo their own personal counseling so they can be emotionally healthy and well and have that foundation to do this work, we believe educators deserve that same opportunity, and so do students, so that they can have a healthy human in front of them, helping them grow every day.
So this is really inspiring, and it's really revolutionary, I think, in terms of transforming what's happening in schools. And I want to ask you to comment a little bit on the sort of cultural tension here that many schools are experiencing. One of the things that I've observed in working with schools and working in education is that we have a legacy kind of model here in our educational system, which draws on metaphors from industry and particularly from computer processing, where we have the vision is sort of like that students are widgets. They're going through this improvement factory. We basically upgrade the widgets and we quality test them and basically, you know, hopefully they meet the quality standard, and that means that the machine is functioning. Then what you see happening in the larger policy environment is the use of quite a lot of data-driven schemes to enhance the quality testing process and to refine the teaching process so that it exposes, you know, weaknesses in development earlier, so you can go about fixing the widgets earlier in the process. Obviously, I'm being a little bit creative in my description, but I do think that this mental model, if you will, underlies a lot of what happens in schools. You're really saying something strikingly different about what this system should be about, that it's really about it's a social, fundamentally a social environment. Learning is interpersonal, learning is relational, and that if we don't have this foundation of a web of really secure relationships, that the learning process doesn't even take place effectively. And so I'm wondering whether you are experiencing that tension in your work as you come up against those people and systems that have been driven in quite a different way. And I'd add in two other ideas, the idea of actually punishing teachers in schools when they don't perform like, the assembly line correctly. So I'm curious how you see that, and do you see this as a revolution, you know, not merely in being more effective, but in really our whole conception of what education is about?
Those are great questions, and I love the way that you articulated the kind of deep systemic issues with how schools are designed. You asked about whether we experience tension against that. I would say we absolutely experience tension against the system, but we never experience tension against the people in the system. What I mean by that is educators and school leaders are frustrated having to operate in the system that's basically been attempted to design a system that's devoid of humanity, but a system that's built on humans. I mean, I don't know a profession that's more human than teaching and learning and being in a school. You cannot take the person out of the professional. And so all sorts of funky things happen when we try to. The immense amount of teacher turnover that we see, I think, is a direct result of the fact that an educator's training does not match their task. They go into the profession with this desire to impact students' lives. They want to care. They want to connect. Then they go into their trainings, and it's technical, as we mentioned. And they go into the school setting, and they end up drowning in the very thing that drew them to the field, the relationships, the emotions, the overwhelm that comes from that when you were not equipped. And so I think that's an example of a tension that comes out between the people in the system and the system itself, which is not designed for people. You see the same thing when educators are exposed to this learning and we ask them to build relationships. They light up because it's what they've always wanted to do. It's a new framework for how to do it that they didn't get exposed to earlier. So they're excited about the toolbox, but overwhelmed because I'm not evaluated on building relationships. My administration comes in and tells me that I need to just kind of control the student behavior. And so what we are saying is revolutionary. It is at odds, unfortunately, with a lot of the beliefs, myths out there in education, a lot of the systemic design of a school, but I have tremendous faith in the people that make up that system and the humanity that they all brought into it and their desire to build a system that respects and honors the humanity of the teachers, students, school leaders, parents alike.
So people feel like they're being liberated from the factory, so to speak, and allowed back into something that really looks more like a community and, as you said, a human undertaking and process.
I think so. I think there's some degree of that liberation and that vision. And what we hope is for that vision to catch, and not only that the educators can change their way of being. That's ultimately what we want to see, so that we can have different kinds of classroom climates and teacher-student relationships that are really paramount. But we need movement leaders in this. We need people who experience this, who listen to this podcast, to push towards this greater vision together, because ultimately we can't just have a whole bunch of people pushing against the system. We actually do need the system to change to reflect the realities of the fact that teaching and learning is relational, and that the best student outcomes, academic, social, and emotional, will come when we acknowledge that truth about who we are as a social species.
This episode is brought to you by Arch Street Press and Better to Speak of It, fostering relationships and results through creativity. Better to Speak of It focuses on core management and personal values in collaboration with Clive Gillinson, Executive and Artistic Director of Carnegie Hall. The book offers specific firsthand experiences from the leaders of key nonprofit, corporate, educational, and cultural institutions, including the Museum of Modern Art and the New York Public Library, as well as major performing artists such as Jesse Norman and Michael Tilson Thomas. Better to Speak of It, available now from Arch Street Press.
So I have another comment that I'll phrase as a question, and I wanted to get your reaction to it, which is that I wonder if this work suggests that we have missed something fundamental about what the real value of our educational system is. You know, when we assess learning, we tend to be focused on abstractly on whether students can do certain things, whether they can recapitulate facts, whether they understand theories, whether they can execute mathematical procedures. But actually, what we know about the real world, when we get out into the real world, is that one of the hardest things we have to do is work with one another. And that, in fact, in schools, the social and emotional learning is something that is perhaps even more fundamental to long-range success in life than the acquisition of knowledge and skills. So I wonder what you think about that, and I'd like you to comment on whether we actually measure that effectively at all. It's ironic to me that we spend all this time measuring something that it turns out might not be the most valuable thing about our education.
Yes, that's a great point. Kind of thinking more fundamentally about the function and purpose of schools is certainly at the core of this discussion that we're having. School, I think most would say, is here to prepare our students, the next generation, for the future. But what future? Our world is moving so incredibly fast that there's no way any of us can predict what that future will look like. And so how can we know what they need to know, what they need to be able to do? I think what you're pointing to is the need for schools to recognize that all we can do and the best we can do for our kids is help prepare them for who to be. And that is going to be the best preparation for ensuring that they're strong and successful in this unknown future that is theirs and is our world's. So how can schools better do that? I think it is very much about this mental shift and this recognition of a teacher's purpose, a teacher tapping into that purpose, which is why most teachers enter the profession anyways, to develop healthy, whole people. But so much of the messaging out there skips over that and focuses on the things right in front of them, getting through the curriculum, passing the assessments, keeping control of the classroom, that we lose sight of that bigger reason why we're here. And so inviting teachers out there to tap back into that and think about, how can I make my classroom a space where I can prepare these students as people for the future, the unknown future that they face? In terms of how is our school design set up for that, I don't think it is. I think that there's much going against it. Your suggestion as to whether we should start measuring it, I'm not so sure myself. I have a lot of fears and trepidations about applying an old measurement system, basically how we would measure math and science and something from an old paradigm, and applying that to, okay, now let's measure resilience and grit. Let's measure self-management and self-awareness. I'm not so sure. I worry about unforeseen consequences of that approach.
That's a great point. And that sometimes, you know, it's kind of like the observer effect, that the measurement of something destroys the thing you're trying to measure.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So let's shift gears a little bit, because I'd love to take our listeners a little bit into the weeds on how FuelEd is doing this really critical work. And I know you have a bunch of strategies, community workshops, your empathy school, you know, your leadership institute. I'd love for you to maybe just frame that for us. If an educational institution wants to engage with FuelEd, what are the pathways and how do you do that work?
Absolutely. So FuelEd partners predominantly with K-12 schools, although we would love for our next frontier to venture into teacher preparation, because it is really why we are founded, to solve this gap in educator preparation so that all teachers get exposed to the knowledge, the skills, the self-awareness necessary to build relationships. So in our work in the last 5 years, we have partnered with K-12 schools, mainly in the Houston area, which is where we're located, to deliver our learning experience that goes over the course of a year that combines workshops and counseling services in order to help instill the science of relationships, the skills of relationships, and the self-awareness of relationships necessary for educators to build those relationships. So for Leadership Institute, it's a 3-day conference where school leaders, district leaders, teacher leaders can come together and learn about a whole range of topics. They could learn about their own attachment styles, student attachment styles, their triggers in relationships, the concept of shame and what it means for learning, as well as exploring even your own shame. So it's certainly not only a professional learning environment, but very much a personal learning environment, because as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to teaching, learning, and education, you really can't take the person out of the professional. They are their own best instrument and can be their own worst enemy in terms of promoting a climate and relationships that either drive learning or can shut down learning. And so coupled with the 3-day Leadership Institute, all educators have access to what we call one-on-ones, which are our counseling services. So we have actually a team of counselors who are there to support every educator who goes through our program, to help them explore really whatever's coming up for them. It could be as quote-unquote superficial as their daily stresses, their overwhelm either in their school environment or their home life, or as deep as looking at their own childhood, developing a better understanding of their ways of being and how that's connected to the ways in which their needs were met or unmet in their early years. So it really runs the gamut, and it's self-directed from the teacher or the educator as to where they want that experience to go. The most important thing about the counseling is that they get to experience a secure relationship where they feel seen, which is a critical component to their own healing, growth, and ability to build secure relationships. In addition to our Leadership Institute, we have a few other trainings. Empathy School predominantly is a day-long, site-based training that's all about the art and science of effective listening. So while you learn a little bit about empathy in Leadership Institute, this is for those who want a deeper dive to really gain the skills to be able to take others' perspectives, to recognize emotion in others, to stay out of judgment, and to communicate understanding, because we believe that's really where the power of empathy lies, not simply cognitively being able to imagine another's perspective, but more deeply being able to communicate, hey, I get you, without saying I get you, so that the folks around us feel really understood and cared for, seen. It's a regulating experience when they have someone who actually sees them. So helping educators learn that skill and then learn how to integrate it. Of course, Empathy School, like all other of our trainings, are followed by a year of counseling services. And we've also just launched a brand new program, Empathy Coaching, for helping educators really begin to apply it and weave it into their daily practice. We'll come out, do a classroom observation, follow that up with some feedback and coaching. And once the educator reaches a level of mastery with their own empathy, we actually can help train them to be an empathy coach to others. And that's a way we're really trying to embed this into school systems so that, for example, instructional coaches for teachers, they'll come in and perhaps not only look out for instructional best practices, but empathic or relational best practices and be able to really support the whole educator. Last but not least, we're actually launching right now our scaling strategy, which is to essentially utilize our most catalyzed alumni as growth partners for Fuel Ed, where they can actually develop their own self-directed communities of practice wherever they live, taking this content and helping folks apply it as Fuel Ed supports them in doing so. So that's a brand new endeavor that we see as our way forward to scaling across the country.
Wow. So that is quite a lot of different things that are going on. I have a question for you about, again, that takes us a little bit back into theory, but so much of this is about modeling what successful relationships are. And I wondered, is there a psychological theory or a family of theories that underlies that work? Because obviously, you know, if you look at the history of psychology, there's been quite a few different players in that space. And I just wonder whether your practice focuses on any particular theoretical underpinning.
It does. Thanks for asking. That's usually not a question we get, but it's one we really like to answer. So I would say there are three schools of thought that greatly influence our work, and they're all basically saying the same thing, which is that relationships drive learning. So the first one is attachment theory. It's the most well-established, well-researched, and documented theory of human relationships out there. And it says that our early relationships with our caregivers shape our brain and our development and shape the way that we see the world and we approach other relationships. So from our romantic relationships to our teacher-student relationships, it's shaped through the schema that's formed from those early attachment relationships. That's attachment theory. Another kind of psychological theory that we are grounded in is interpersonal neurobiology or social neuroscience, made very popular by Dr. Dan Siegel. Dr. Lou Cozzolino is also in that club. And it's all about how the science, the brain science behind basically attachment theory and how we as humans are social creatures and we regulate one another with our relationships. When we're connected or disconnected, it actually impacts our biology. So that's the second foundation. And thirdly, I would say in the counseling field, it would be client-centered or person-centered psychology or counseling, made popular and led by the renowned psychologist, Dr. Carl Rogers, who had a belief that all people have the innate capacity to become their best selves. And it just happens naturally. It's called the self-actualizing tendency. It's kind of beautiful kind of concept that we all naturally tend towards our self-actualized state. But it happens only under certain conditions. So then it begs the question, well, what are those conditions? Dr. Rogers talked about the three core conditions being a relationship characterized by empathy, genuineness, and unconditional positive regard or apprising and acceptance of another person for who they are. And so both our work in what we try to give over to teachers, the style in which we teach, as well as the style of counseling we take on, is all founded on the person-centered or client-centered frame of looking at the world and people by Carl Rogers.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I think it may be interesting for people who want to follow up and do some reading. And obviously, I guess Dr. Cozzolino's book would be a good place to start with a reading list.
Yeah, and we actually have a reading list on our website. So feel free to check that out at fueledschools.org.
Fueledschools.org, yes. Tell us a little. I have one other question for you, and then we'll sort of shift gears to closing out the conversation today. But I wanted to ask you about the future of research, the future of practice. If you're looking forward, what do you aspire to, and what is some of the work that you think needs to be done to get there?
Great questions. I think a lot about the field of social emotional learning and the way that it's taken off in the last few years, but the work that's really been foundational over the last few decades building. My hope for that field is that the recognition of the importance of the teacher's own social emotional development as a critical prerequisite to building an environment and relationships that develop students socially emotionally. I really hope that comes into the awareness and the practices that are going on out there with social emotional learning. A fear for that field is that we'll just take the same approach, this kind of didactic instructional approach that hasn't worked and doesn't work for traditional learning around academics, and apply that same approach to now these social emotional competencies. Let me teach them to students. What we know from the research is that those things aren't taught and learned cognitively like some other skills or knowledge. They develop on the stage of a relationship. So understanding the critical importance of relationship and the educator's own emotional intelligence in order to build those relationships, the self-development of the educator, I do hope that that field, that kind of subset of the field, really moves in that direction, because there's such an incredible group of people pulling for that and making wonderful systemic changes. At the district here in Houston ISD, there's a director of social emotional learning that never would have existed before. And so in seeing the systemic changes that are taking place, I hope that we continue to move in a direction that's founded by the research that's out there around the importance of developmental experiences with a caregiver in a relationship that's secure. And my other hope for the field is around educator preparation. There's so much awesome innovation happening in educator preparation right now, a lot of really great energy. And I hope that we can think out of the box to give educators what they really need so that it's relevant to them, it's applicable to them, it's powerful to them, and they feel equipped to not only survive their first year, but to thrive for many years in the profession, because we need educators, strong educators, healthy educators, whole educators in those seats in schools every day doing the incredible work they do.
One of the things that's so beautiful about listening to you talk about this is that I think many people look at the future of education with a sense of uncertainty and worry about institutions that are going to devolve into sort of computer programs with people sitting at home like stuck to a screen. And the picture that you're painting is so strikingly different from that. It really is underscoring that if the future is smartly approached, it will be more human, more interactive, with more opportunities for the kind of face-to-face community setting learning that is so not only effective but valuable to the heart and the emotions. And so it's just great to hear you dream about the future in that way. I think maybe our listeners will react with a sense of optimism and hope, which we don't have enough of right in the world today.
Right.
So I'd like, many people listening to the program are early stage entrepreneurs, people perhaps studying social entrepreneurship. And I'd love for you, before we close out, to just share a little practical advice and inspiration. I know that when people look at someone like you, Megan, they see the success, they see the accolades, and I always say it's like watching a professional athlete and editing out all their mistakes.
Yeah, very much.
There are a lot of hard spots to get where you are, and I wonder if you could share some of what has kept you motivated through those hard spots, you know, wisdom along the journey, really, for people who are listening today. What do you have for us?
Thank you. And I will definitely double down on that, that it has not been all, you know, roses and butterflies. There's definitely been some very tough moments in the history of Fuel Ed, and it's a constant up and down. So I think your question as to what keeps me going, I would say there's two main things that have kept me personally going that fuel me. One is just a sense of purpose around this. I did not intend to become a social entrepreneur. I had no desire for this life. I was called to it. So this sense of calling and purpose gives me faith in really dark times when I'm struggling, when I'm doubting myself, which always, you know, is you know, kind of very frequent. It happens a lot. Because there's so many tough moments and a need to pull on the inner resources to get around that next hurdle. So that sense of calling, that purpose, that vision that I feel I was given for this work is something that really feeds me. I feel a sense of responsibility. The other thing, and go figure, it's the relationships. I feel really blessed to have some wonderful personal and professional relationships, people who are cheerleading for me, who are getting my back when I'm feeling a little weak, who are telling me, like my husband, whenever I'm like, I can't do this. He says, you're not quitting. Like, it's not an option. So, you know, having those secure relationships are what has given me the strength to carry on and to push forward. And then hearing the stories of the kiddos out there who really need someone to have those kinds of relationships that can help them, someone to believe in them, to keep them going. It's sort of all the inspiration I need to wake up, do it again another day, and continue pushing forward.
That's so great. Well, I'm inspired, and I know that many people listening today will be. I just want to thank you for sharing time with us today, and thank you for this, for your passionate commitment to this work. And I know we're going to catch up with you again in the future and find out what's happening with Fuel Ed.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to have been able to share in this conversation with you and your listeners, and would love to keep our conversation going and connect to anyone out there who's similarly passionate about this work.
Excellent. And the best way to find you is at fueledschools.org. And is there any other place where listeners should go to keep up with you and learn about what's latest? You are on Twitter, I guess. And
yes, on Twitter, Fuel Ed Schools, on Facebook, same name. And our website, you can check out what we do as well as contact us if you would like to join the movement or be part of the work that we're doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press for PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.